This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. This year, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is presenting its honorary Oscars in a separate ceremony taking place in Hollywood this weekend, rather than on the televised Oscar Awards in March. Planning to attend to accept their awards are actress Lauren Bacall, filmmaker Roger Corman, and our first guest, cinematographer Gordon Willis. Willis was nominated for only two Academy Awards during his career to date, for Woody Allen's Zelig and for The Godfather Part III. He didn't win for either. But his string of stunningly photographed movies speaks for itself. Here are scenes from a few of his classic films.
He'd come to me in friendship. Then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Mitchell was in control.
Wait a minute.
There were men working under Mitchell.
How many?
I don't know how many, but the men working under Mitchell were the ones that received the money from the slush fund.
Okay, do we know how much money we're talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these men are the key to what that money was used for. Boy, that woman was paranoid. At one point, I suddenly wondered how high up this thing goes, and her paranoia finally got to me. I thought what we had was so hot that any minute CBS or NBC are going to come in through the windows and take the story.
We're both paranoid. She's afraid of John Mitchell, and you're afraid of Walter Cronkite.
Right.
Can we go back to what?
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Well, bye.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la.
In that sequence, we heard Marlon Brando in The Godfather, Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford in All the President's Men, and Woody Allen and Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, three films on which Gordon Willis served as cinematographer. He shot eight Woody Allen movies and the entire Godfather trilogy. His other films include Clute, The Parallax View, and Pennies from Heaven. In 2002, Terry Gross invited Gordon Willis to talk about some of his films, starting with The Godfather, which was released in 1972. She began by asking him about the guiding principles behind the look of that film.
You know, for a while, I really didn't know what to do with that movie. You know, I thought about it for weeks, and I finally decided, I thought, this should be, have this kind of brassy yellow look to it. Don't ask me why. It just felt right, you know. So that was the first thing that I applied in my thinking. And the other part of the thinking was I should have this kind of New York street look, one foot in the gutter, 40s kind of feeling, a little dirty. And so I was satisfied with that kind of feeling in my mind. And then the other thing is, well, I thought, you know, we didn't get the money to go to Sicily until about two-thirds of the way through the movie when the Paramount people realized that they had something better than a cheap crime novel on their hands. So they gave us the money to go to Sicily. So I figured at that point, Sicily should look, you know, mythical and sunny and kind of storybook feeling. So that there was a juxtaposition between these two places, New York and Sicily, and there was a counterpoint when we went back and forth.
Let me ask you about one of the kind of most famous scenes in the first Godfather movie. And that's right. When the studio executive, who isn't playing ball with the Corleone family,
right,
wakes up in his silk sheets, in his satin, cover, to find that his bed is basically flooded with blood because the decapitated head of his horse is underneath the covers. Can you talk about shooting that scene?
It was very hot that day. It was kind of smelly. I think for animal lovers, you have to know that this was a real horse's head, by the way. But it was a horse that had already died and one that was, pardon me, in the glue factory already. So they acquired the horse and kept it on ice. And, you know, we put it in bed and when we were ready, after we were through lighting, et cetera, and off we went. But as I said, I prefaced it by saying it was hot that day. So once you took this horse out of the ice, it got a little gamey. So It was kind of the last thing we did. But it was real. Real horse.
And what were your concerns as the cinematographer of that scene?
Well, my concern always is just getting it right. I mean, you know, getting the visualization of the moment, getting that right. That's always my concern.
And what did getting it right mean in this situation where a guy is kind of waking up out of a dream, senses something's wrong, and then realizes this absolutely horrible thing has happened, this absolutely horrible thing is happening in his bed, and he's just like screaming?
Well, from my point of view, getting it right means seeing it at the level that you should see it from an audience point of view, perceiving it properly, visually.
What are some of the changes you made between the first Godfather and Godfather II in terms of, for instance, how you shot the interiors? Because Godfather II, it's a different decade. It's a different generation.
Right. Well, one of the things you have to do, or one of the things that I decided to do, was that since these are sister movies and that they really work together in a sense, is that I maintained this same color structure in the second Godfather. It was this yellow, kind of yellow that went. However, the content of the structure of the photography I changed because of this turn of the century feeling in the retrospective footage. And then we went from, you know, 1902 up to 1950-something in Lake Tahoe. So it was tricky because you had New York, then you had Sicily, which had to be different, but still in the same time period. And then, you know, you had Lake Tahoe in the 50s. So when you have an audience watching this kind of film, you don't want to push too much visual information at too many different levels. You want to be able, they should be able to watch the movie, take it in, know they're in a different place and be able to accept that without getting in the way of telling the story. I mean, at one point, Francis said to me, how are we going to know where we are here? We're going from here to there to there to here. I said, look, you know, when we get to New York and you say, New York, 19 so-so. When you get to France, say, put a one-liner under it. I said, it's been done for years. It's classy. Everybody will know where they are, and there won't be a problem. So there were presentation of a story that was that long and that complex. You want to present simply, you know, because the simple is the most elegant, you know.
What were the streets in New York, or the parts of New York, that were easiest to transform convincingly to the turn of the century?
Jesus, none of them. It was, we were downtown in the Lower East Side, and what happened was we had one east to west block, which the art department, Dean Tavolaris, who did a great job, it changed. Changed means, you know, you redo everything. You redo all the storefronts, the buildings, and the buildings, for the most part, the superstructure of the building were about the same, but all the storefronts and everything had to be put back in time. So it was very complex. And then, of course, you see past that into more contemporary streets at the very end, which I had to block out with big tarps and things that became sort of transfused into the visual. You couldn't see them. It was tough.
We had to put tarps over whole buildings?
I put tarps over whole buildings, not based on what I just said, but I'd hang them like two blocks away so you couldn't see down. But I had to tarp one whole side of the street. people were yelling at us. We pulled tarps right up in front of the windows. But because the sun would hit that side of the street, that side of the building, and bounce into the street, and we couldn't do that. You know, we had to have continuity in the visual structure, so there were two reasons for tarps. One to kill sun, and one so you couldn't see across town.
In the Godfather films, there are so many great actors, different generations of great actors, different types of acting styles. You've got De Niro, Pacino, Brando, Lee Strasberg. What was there anything that had to change in your approach to shooting them because of their different approaches to acting? Or for example, was one of them the kind who wanted to do a scene over and over again, and another the kind of actor who believes first take is best take?
Yeah, you've always got a certain amount of that while you're working. Regarding the structure of the movie, they had to do what, you know, we laid out, and you sort of work in concert to make sure everybody's comfortable, but that's the design of the movie. As far as the way they function, yeah, you know, Al would like to do things in a certain way, and actually the most definitive actor was Lee Strasberg. He had no problems doing it and doing it well and not doing it a whole lot, you know. Marlon Brando didn't like to do a lot of takes either. I don't remember him being particularly indulgent, wanting to do too many, but, you know, it depends on how secure an actor is within the structure of the scene and the material, how far he wants to go with it. I think Bobby De Niro was kind of the most method actor in the group, and Bob would take a while to get to the place that he thought was good, almost to the point drive you crazy, you know, how to pick up an apple. You know, 25 minutes later, he's still trying to pick it up 3-4 different ways. I mean, yeah, Francis said, just pick the apple up and eat it. I mean, you know, so, but everybody has their own way in, you know, and finally, if it works, that's all that matters.
I'm sure you realize that, you know, when Brando was in The Godfather, everybody would be studying him to see, what did he look like? How had he changed? What's his acting like now?
Oh, yeah.
So how did that affect how you shot him, knowing that he had a look, you know, pretty iconic in this movie, that he was a much older man than people remembered, and that he was no longer going to be like the kind of sex icon that, you know, that he was?
Yeah, well, of course, all that worked in our favor because just to recap this business about asking about photography on the first movie, the thing that happened or that had to happen was Marlon said, well, I have this idea, you know, about this makeup and everything. He says, but, you know, it has to be photographed. I said, sure, I know. So we shot these tests, which are actually those tests are available on some of the re-releases of Godfather and DVD. But so we went into the studio, and he stuffs the stuff in his mouth, and he puts on a few things, and make a long story short, I had to design the lighting so that Marlon looked right in the movie when you first see him in the office and when you see him in the rest of the movie. And the design of that lighting had to work for Marlon, but it also had to be able to take it in through the rest of the movie to be able to apply it everywhere. So actually it was him and his makeup and his look that actually were responsible for the designing the overall look of the lighting, which was not only carried through one, but was carried through two as well.
So what was it that you needed to do lighting-wise to get his look right?
Yeah, the bottom line of it is it all had to be overhead lighting because, well, there were two things. I didn't really want to see his eyes that well, although I was criticized for it, because I didn't want anybody to say, well, he didn't want to quite know what he was thinking all the time, you know. And in order to make the makeup work, we had to have this sort of overhead lighting to give him this look that he had. And, of course, everybody else had to have, selectively, had to be subjected to the same kind of lighting to make the movie hold together visually.
There's this great operatic sequence in Godfather 1 that intercuts between a baptismal scene in a church and these Corleone mob murders. And can you talk a little bit about the kind of shooting that you did to give it that operatic look?
What happened was, it was Francis's idea to use this counterpoint of taking this baby, this child, in the environment of a church, and the dialogue that went with it, denouncing the devil, etc., and at the same time putting the counterpoint of killing everybody against that image. So that idea in itself sort of holds the whole thing together. So it's the idea, it's the counterpoint that makes this so strong, of a baby renouncing the devil and a baby being christened in the middle of the church, and then the counterpoint of all these people being murdered. So it wouldn't mean much. A lot of people have tried to do that in movies since, by the way, one form or another. But
I noticed.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Yeah. Yeah. But it wouldn't mean much if you, you know, finished that scene, got in a car and drove away and then started the other stuff. So it, what means something is the counterpoint of it, you know, you know, Richie Castellano shooting somebody in an elevator and then somebody machining somebody else in bed and then somebody getting shot. It's I don't want to use the word fun, but it's fun to watch that kind of structure. It's definitive and it works, you know.
Let's talk about working on Woody Allen's movies. Manhattan is shot in black and white. Right. Was that your idea or Woody Allen's idea?
Well, actually, it was Woody's idea because he loves black and white. So do I.
Why do you love black and white?
I don't know. I look at New York. It's kind of a black and white city to me. It's, you know, when you work in color, it's a burden. It can be a burden to an audience if you don't use it properly, and it's a burden to the people who are working with it because if you don't make the right choices in color, you don't make the right choices in clothes, you don't make the right choices, you know, then it all comes together. It looks good. Whereas in black and white, you're really working in values, you know, grays, blacks and white. So actually the visual structure in a black and white movie can become more difficult in one sense because you have to pay attention to values, you know, separating people from backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. And I just find the content in a black and white movie sometimes can be a lot easier to watch because you don't have this kind of color thing going on, you know.
Did Woody Allen ask you to go back and watch a lot of Ingmar Bergman movies before working with him? Because Woody Allen's such a Bergman fan, and there's so many Bergman references in his films.
Right. No, he never asked me to watch anything. All of his movies are designed from the ground up. I mean, I must say that working with Woody for 10 years was like a vacation. I mean, I had so much fun. And I think I probably like Woody a lot more than he likes me, because I'm kind of a carnivore when I'm making movies. You know, I want to get it done. I want to get it done the right way, and I don't, you know, want to fool around. But from the standpoint of working with a man who's, you know, it's like working with your hands in your pockets when you're working with Woody. It's a very easy, off-the-cuff kind of day. And I don't mean that we don't plan. We do. And the movies are designed to look like they're off the cuff, but they're not. But it's just working with him as a personality was a pleasure. And I also like working with writers. I mean, because if something's not working, you know, you take the pencil, you cross it out, and throw the page away, and you do something else. You know, it's much faster than working with a director who can't write, who has to get on the phone and talk to the, you know, thing. This way, you know, it's right there. So he tears it out, and they start again. You know, it's quick.
You live in Cape Cod now, which is known, right, among other things, for its beautiful light.
Right.
Is that something that means a lot to you?
Yeah, it means a lot to me, not so much from the standpoint that, I want to rip out a camera. Light means a lot to me in life. You know, I mean, I hate to be in rooms that don't have dimension and beautiful light. And I have the same feeling about living in a place that doesn't have dimension and beautiful light. I mean, I hate Los Angeles. It's like living inside a toaster oven, you know. It's awful. The light stinks. The only time I like it there is really in winter when it's a little bit better. But I love New York light in the winter. Winter light is so beautiful. It's beautiful here in the winter.
Can you describe New York light?
I can describe New York light mostly in the winter because it's like my favorite thing. You move from light to dark. You know, you move from a brilliant splash of sun to kind of like a midnight shadow, you know, and you watch the sun come up in the east and go down in the west in New York, and it's like, you know, it looks like welding sometimes. It's so beautiful. It's stunning. mainly because it's moving through all of these buildings, you know, and it bounces through windows and off windows and down into the street. It's always changing, which is quite wonderful. Unless you happen to be photographing something, then you want to hurry up so you get it the right way. But it's just as stunning.
Cinematographer Gordon Willis speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. The man who shot Manhattan, All the President's Men, and The Godfather, among others, receives an honorary Oscar in Hollywood this weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Rivers Cuomo, is the lead singer, guitarist, and principal songwriter of the band Weezer. The group has a new album out called Ratitude. Here's the opening track. Weezer first got attention in the mid-90s, when the videos for their songs Undone, The Sweater Song, and Buddy Holly got a lot of airplay on MTV. The band has continued to record and perform, sometimes with long breaks in between. During that time, Rivers Cuomo has written many songs that never made it onto Weezer albums, but which he released as solo albums of home recordings. The stories behind those songs reveal a lot about his life and musical influences. He spent part of his childhood on an ashram and went back to Harvard to study music and literature after becoming a rock star. Terry spoke with Rivers Cuomo earlier this year and started by asking about one song in particular. Not one of Weezer's earliest hits, but a track from the group's follow-up album.
Weezer's first CD was a real success. The second CD, not so much. It was called Pinkerton, and it got slammed by some of the critics and didn't sell nearly as well as the first. But it has some great songs on it, and I want to play one of the songs from it, which I find really interesting. And you've spoken in the past about how this album was inspired in part by your love of Puccini and, you know, great romantic operas. And this is like a comic romantic song that's called Pink Triangle.
Mm.
And it's about falling in love with a woman who turns out to be a lesbian. And it's like you find that incredibly, you know, the character is singing in the song finds this like incredibly upsetting because he was sure they'd be able to get married. And there's yeah. a great line in it, like, everyone's a little queer. Why can't she be a little straight?
Yeah.
So is this song based at all on a relationship that you had, or is it just a character?
Most of the songs I write are just very directly from my life. I don't have a big imagination. Whenever I try to write from fantasy, it comes out sounding really fake. So I just pretty much write exactly what's happening to me most of the time. And so that's what this song is. I got to Harvard in 96, really happy to be there, and I saw a girl in class, and she was so beautiful and so cool, and I watched her over the weeks, and, you know, all kinds of fantasies started happening about getting married. And then one day she came to school with a button on her, it's actually on her backpack, not on her sleeve like in the lyric. Sometimes they change a detail here or there, but that's not important. So it was on her backpack, and it was a button of a pink triangle, and I took that to mean that she was a lesbian. And I was crushed, and it, at the same time, it seemed like a really novel experience for me, and confusing and interesting, and I went home and wrote a song about it. And then I found out, after the album came out, a year and a half later, that she wasn't a lesbian at all. She just was showing support for gay rights or something.
Was it too late for you?
I was on to something else at that point, I'm sure.
That's really funny. Well, I'm glad you got a really terrific song out of it. So this is Pink Triangle from Weezer's second album, Pinkerton.
When I'm stable.
A period, and maybe you still feel like you're in this period, when you were struggling to figure out what kind of songs you wanted to write and what your best songwriting process was to come up with a decent story. So you started keeping a journal and experimenting with different approaches to writing songs. It sounds like a very analytical approach to something that for some songwriters is really very intuitive. Can you describe a little bit a couple of the different processes that you tried in songwriting?
Yeah, for a couple years there. Well, I've always been an analytical person, but for a couple years I just got really analytical in keeping track of every detail of the process of writing a song and intentionally varying individual elements to see what the result would be. But sometimes these experiments were indistinguishable from how any other rock person would write a song. For example, in mid-2000, my experiments evolved to the point where step one was take a pill of Ritalin. Step two was take 3 shots of tequila. Step three was go out in the backyard, sit down in a chair. Step four was close your eyes and imagine the song. And that's how I wrote Hash Pipe.
So should we hear some of the song that was the outcome of this experiment?
Yeah, sure. I think you'll hear it.
Okay, here it comes. One of my favorite songs on Alone 2 is a song called I Was Scared, which is about an event when you were a junior in high school and you were being bullied by jocks.
Yeah.
So tell us the story of what happened that led to this song.
Well, junior year of high school is when I figured out how to do my hair. And I was really into heavy metal at the time, and I had been experimenting with different kinds of mousse and gel and blow drying and scrunching and all these different techniques. And then one day I figured it out, and my hair just popped up. and it looked, I thought it looked amazing, but boy, the jocks didn't like it. And me and all my friends, of course, were wearing heavy metal type clothing to school, and we weren't necessarily the biggest guys, so we'd get pushed around all the time. And on one occasion, they made us an offer that if my brother would fight this one guy, David, they would, you know, that would be the one final fight, and then they would leave us alone after that. And so we put it all on him, and he said yes, he would do it. And the understanding was that the rest of us had to stay inside. Now, I knew very well that all the other guys, all our other enemies were going out there to surround him, and they did. But I stayed inside like a total coward, and I felt so guilty about that, like I'd betrayed my brother, and of course I had. I pretty much buried that in my unconscious mind for years. And then in 2003, what's that, 16 years later, I was doing some intensive meditation, and suddenly this tremendous feeling of guilt came up. And as soon as I got out of that meditation course, I ran to my guitar and wrote the song, I Was Scared.
That's a great song. Let's hear it. And here's Rivers Cuomo from his new CD, Alone 2, and he's doing all the parts on this.
Listen to me, I've got to clear the air. There's something I've held way down deep inside all these years. You always were a friend. You always trusted me, but now I must admit that I was not trustworthy. I let you down, I sold you out, I turned away as you fell onto the ground. I was scared, and I was terrified. I was lost, and so I shied away.
That's I Was Scared from Rivers Cuomo's new solo CD, Alone 2. There's a version of I Was Scared that's on the internet now where you had basically held these open auditions through the internet to find a pianist and an a cappella group to accompany you performing I Was Scared. And it sounds terrific. I want you to talk about why you heard piano in your mind for this, because on the recording that we just heard from your album Alone 2, it's guitar based. So why did you also hear piano as an option for this? And along with that, why did you want to hold auditions on the internet? I guess that's kind of the larger question.
Well, I know growing up in middle school and in high school, I was very into classical music and classical singing, and then later even opera. And so I have this other side to me that's very into art music and Schubert and Schumann songs, and a lot of these are just piano vocal arrangements. I've never really gotten a chance to do that with Weezer, and now with YouTube, I can pretty much the world is available to me. I can put up a call for musicians, and I've gotten hundreds of replies, and I can just pick whichever one feels right to me. And in this case with I Was Scared, I heard it being something like a really aggressive Schumann song or something, not just a piano strumming chords like along to a pop song like My Day Is Coming or something, but somebody who could really shred. And because the chord progression's so simple, somebody who could come up with very intense variations to make it interesting over the course of 3.5 minutes. So this one girl replied who is a Juilliard student, and she's just a fantastic musician with all the technique and power, and I knew it was going to be great. And it was one of the most fun things I've ever done.
Well, I really like it. So here's a version of the song we just heard, I Was Scared, and Rivers Cuomo is singing lead. And tell me the name of the pianist who you found through the internet.
Her name is Sonia.
Okay, well, we'll keep it to that.
And, that's all I know.
And the name of the a cappella group accompanying you, who you also found through the internet?
These guys are part of the Dartmouth Airs, which is the male a cappella group at Dartmouth.
Well, here they are.
New Hampshire.
With Rivers Cuomo, and this is just from the internet.
Listen to me, I've got to clear the air. There's something I've held way down deep inside all these years. You always were a friend, you always trusted me. But now I must admit that I was not trustworthy. I let you down, I sold you out. I turned away as you fell onto the ground.
It's Rivers Cuomo with a pianist and an a cappella group that he found through internet auditions. Now, you mentioned that you're not only interested in pop and rock, you're interested in classical music and art song and opera, and you studied classical composition at Harvard for a while before dropping out and then coming back as an English major and completing your degree. But you've said that you didn't really like the atonal music that was emphasized at Harvard. Give us a sense of the kind of music that you just weren't warming up to.
Well, at the time, this is 96, I was in my hardcore romantic phase. I was so in love with Puccini and Tchaikovsky, stuff like that. And I got to Harvard wanting to learn how to do that. And, of course, that music is not only 100 years old, but it was just completely out of style after the 20th century and everything that happened. But several years later, I got another music teacher, and I was in a different frame of mind, and I really came to love some of that 20th century music, Stravinsky and Bartok and even Schoenberg, stuff like that. I got this great composition teacher who taught me private lessons from UCLA, and he actually, some of the homework assignments he gave me at that time, 2004, I integrated into a song on Weezer's latest album, the Red Album, called The Greatest Man That Ever Lived. At the end of that song, it's a six-minute song, very epic, and at the end there's all this vocal counterpoint. He taught me how to do all that, and actually a lot of it is from a homework assignment he gave me.
What was the assignment?
It was I was learning how to write three-part vocal counterpoint in the style of the 16th century. And as soon as the album was finished, I sent it to him. I knew he would be overjoyed to hear his influence on a modern rock record. You know, as a college professor in a somewhat obscure field, you might start to think, like, how relevant is this anymore? And he probably would have been overjoyed to hear that on the Weezer record. He was such an enthusiastic guy. And I was sad to learn that he passed away before he had a chance to hear the album.
I'm sorry to hear that. But yeah. We should listen to the track that you just mentioned. So we'll hear the end of it, where the choral music influence comes in.
My favorite Weezer song ever.
Greatest Man Who Ever Lived from Weezer's latest, the Red Album.
Greatest Man That Ever Lived.
It's intentionally
incorrect.
Oh, okay. Why?
Actually, it just sings better.
Well, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you, and I wish you continued good luck with your explorations in music.
Thank you very much, and I'm so excited to talk to you. This is great.
Oh, that means a lot to me. Thank you.
Rivers Cuomo speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His band Weezer has a new album out called Ratitude. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Fresh Air. The original British series The Prisoner, starring Patrick McGoohan as a secret agent hauled off to a remote and mysterious place known as The Village, was shown on American TV in 1968. In a very volatile year, it was stunningly political. It questioned authority and championed independence. It was one of TV's first true miniseries, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Even if that ending, the 60s equivalent of the blackout finale of The Sopranos, infuriated as many viewers as it pleased. And even though we never knew the name of the hero, it was easy to identify with him. For reasons unknown but doubtlessly noble, he resigned his job as a spy, and the entire series is an attempt by his village captors to uncover his true motives. Each week, a village official known as Number Two tries to crack the hero using a different approach. Each week brings failure, and the following week, a new Number Two. Meanwhile, our hero, played by McGoohan, continues to rage against the machine, and even against his given identity in the village, Number Six.
Where am I? In the village.
What do you want?
Information.
Whose side are you on?
That would be telling. We want information. Information. Information.
You won't get it.
By hook or by crook, we will.
Who are you?
The new Number Two.
Who is Number One?
You are Number Six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
The original Prisoner series was shown on CBS as a summer replacement for the Jackie Gleason show. Needless to say, it was noticed, and still is, for being jarringly, daringly different. My interpretation of the controversial ending, by the way, is that it revealed Number Six as the village's Number One, that we are all held captive by metaphorical prisons of our own design, that sort of thing. I could go on and on about the original Prisoner, and I'm tempted to, because the new version, beginning Sunday on cable's AMC, is such a disappointment. AMC, in trying to make a name for itself as a presenter of quality TV, had a perfect record up to now. First, it presented the Robert Duvall Western miniseries Broken Trail, then the superb drama series Mad Men, great season finale, by the way, and, most recently, another daring drama, Breaking Bad. Triple, home run, home run. And now, with its new Prisoner, an embarrassing strikeout. Except for the casting of Ian McKellen as Number Two, this new six-hour TV version seems to make changes that weaken the concept rather than play to its strengths. For Prisoner fans, there's a lot to be irritated by. There's only one Number Two rather than a succession of adversaries. And even the honorific prefix Number is dropped. The head of the village is simply Two now, just as our captive hero, played in the new miniseries by Jim Caviezel, is Six. That just sounds wrong, like when the first adaptation of a 007 novel, made for American TV before the movies came out, referred to that spy as Jimmy Bond. Honest. Writer-producer Bill Gallagher respects some of the old touches to keep them intact. A few villagers still end each conversation with, "be seeing you." There's still a mysterious oversized oval that serves as a sort of sentient watchdog. And one scene, in which Six tries to buy a village map, is still a strong nod to the original series premiere. Each hour, Two tries to unearth Six's secrets, but this time, Six is not even a spy, just a corporate middleweight. But most plots are original and aren't improved by their originality. Instead of filming at the quaint yet modern resort on the coast of Wales where the original was filmed, this new Prisoner, set in the present, prefers a desert and mountain setting, filmed partly in Namibia. It's added lots of recurring characters, including a teen son for Number Two, named 1112, presumably intended to hold younger viewers. Another bad move. The only scenes that work are the ones with McKellen. Where Patrick McGoohan was magnetic, Jim Caviezel, who played the title role in The Passion of the Christ, almost fails to register. Put the two actors in the same scene, as in this early interrogation between Two and Six, and you're in danger of rooting for the wrong side.
Why are you keeping me here?
I see no locked doors.
Well, they were after me.
Ooh, sounds terribly ominous.
Why am I here? It has nothing to do with me, any of this. I've seen you before.
Really? What are you doing in the mountains, Six?
I was was lost. I mean, I have no idea how I got here. What did you call me? This, look, something's wrong here.
Yes, you are wrong, Six.
Do not call me that. I am not Six.
This new prisoner tries to be mysterious and compelling, like ABC's Lost. But it's not so much lost as misguided. The original, despite its serious themes, had a great sense of fun. AMC's new prisoner just seems glum and seems a lot longer than 6 hours. My advice, seek out the original, skip the remake. You can download podcasts of our show at freshhour.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.